I think we could change these lights just a fraction, not as much as... Oh, my word. I've had quick answers to prayer, but that's ridiculous. Let me repeat my thanks to Tim and others who invited me to be here with you today. You heard early on my reluctance to come, but I'm glad that I did. I've thoroughly enjoyed meeting so many people and having the privilege of worshiping with you and, of course, listening to the other two speakers. And I've suddenly realized I needn't feel diffident. I have an advantage over both of them. I speak English. I don't know if the details of my topics are in any schedules that you've been given, but there is in mine, and I have been asked if I would speak for this session on an extraordinary title called Does God Believe in Atheists? It's based on a book that was not available this morning. I'll mention to you later why it's available this afternoon, and it boggles the mind that it should have got here in time for this. I thought for a moment, Tim had said, that's enough, you can sit down now. But no, he's just coming to sit in a more comfortable place. I'll tell you at the end of my session, when I have been invited to just say a word or two about some of those books, and the way this book has got here really is quite extraordinary. Now, it is an unusual title. Soon after it was published, a friend of mine in Northern Ireland was on holiday in the Republic of Ireland in the south, and he was in a coffee shop, and he heard a conversation going on at the next table. And at the next table, the girl said to her father, I've just seen a video made by the man who wrote the book you're reading at the moment. Oh, said the father, what book is that? And she said, well, it's a very big book. I think it's called Does God Believe in Anesthetics? Now, I want you to... Look. Not does God believe in anesthetics, it's does God believe in atheists? And it is, of course, an unusual title. Let me begin with Bertrand Russell, mentioned him in the earlier session, a remarkable man, one of the most colorful thinkers of the 20th century, a peer of the realm, an essayist, a mathematician, a Nobel Prize winner, civil rights activist, long-time president of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, heavily involved in education and in liberal politics. He wrote over 60 books on a great variety of subjects, including logic, China, marriage, geometry, communism, and religion. He was also a passionate and dogmatic atheist. In simple language, he didn't believe that God existed. And this, of course, filtered through into his public teaching and to his speaking. Let me give you some of the conclusions he reached. On the existence of the universe, Russell said, the world is simply there and has no explanation, unquote. In other words, it's just one of those things. What's the next question? Let's move on. On the existence of man, he said, man's origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his love and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, unquote. In other words, we are just a bunch of accidents that have come together in the way that we have. There's no rhyme nor reason for our being here. On the subject of morality, he said, it is for us to determine the good life, that is, what is right and wrong. Not for nature, not even nature personified as God, unquote. In other words, we should all be free to choose, and we touched on this earlier, our own moral standards. His own allowed him to be a notorious womanizer and even to have an affair with his own daughter-in-law when he was 79 and she was 26. On the subject of human destiny, Russell said this, brief and powerless is man's life on him and on all his race. The slow, sure doom falls, pitiless and dark, unquote. On another occasion, just as eloquently but less elegantly, he said, when I die, I shall rot, unquote. In other words, in Russell's view, in a few years from now, we will just be worm's meat, as the Puritans delightfully called us. And so that's all there is to us. Well, it all sounds very depressing to me, but it's consistent. It's precisely what a person is left with when God is ruled out. Russell was once asked, but what would you do if at the end of life you were to meet with God and God were to ask you, why didn't you believe in me while you were living on earth? Russell didn't bat an eyelid. He said, I'd look him straight in the face and say, not enough evidence. And all I want to do in this session is to show you that Russell was wrong. He was wrong in a number of really fundamental ways. I want to begin with the existence and the nature of the universe in which we live. What is it when we look up on the night sky and see what is above our heads? There's a lovely story told of an astronomer who gave a lecture, and he explained the sun, moon, and stars and their place in the cosmos and all the rest of it, and then invited comments. And a little old lady said to him, well, I think you've talked a load of rubbish. The world is actually a flat plate supported on the back of a giant turtle. Oh, said the scientist, that's very interesting. Not heard that before. And what's the turtle standing on? And the lady looked exasperated and said, well, on the back of a larger turtle. Well, what holds up the larger turtle? And the scientist said, don't be silly, that's easy. The lady said, it's turtles all the way down. Now, we can do better than that. Let me quote you a man called Stephen Hawking, not to be confused with Richard Dawkins. Stephen Hawking is arguably the most easily recognizable scientist in the world today, confined as he is to a wheelchair and speaking amazingly with the aid of that voice synthesizer. Stephen Hawking calls our Earth a medium-sized planet orbiting around an average star in the outer suburbs of an ordinary spiral galaxy. That is brilliant. I wish I'd thought of it first. I wouldn't have to give him credit for it. It's brilliant. But let's just examine this. This medium-sized planet, the Earth, is about 13,000 miles in diameter. It's 140,000 kilometers in circumference. It has a surface area of about 320 million square kilometers. Well, he says it's a medium-sized planet. It's orbiting around an average star, the sun, which is 1 million times the size of our Earth. And this activity is going on what he delightfully calls the outer suburbs of an ordinary spiral galaxy. Well, the spiral galaxy, I'm going to give it to you in miles now because it's easier for me, 621,000 million million miles across, contains 100,000 million stars, and is one of 100,000 million galaxies in the known universe. Well, that's mind-boggling. And for the atheist, indeed for anybody, any thinking person who gets those figures before them, it raises an obvious question. How did it all get there? That's a lot of stuff. How did it all get there? Well, believe it or not, there are only three possibilities about the origin of the universe. It's either always been there, or it created itself, or it was created by a reality greater than itself. Let's look at those quickly. Firstly, the idea that it is eternal. I guess that's what Russell had in mind when he said the world is simply there. That used to go under the name, I guess it still does, of the steady state theory. And it was once all the rage, but almost nobody believes it now because of what we know about the existence of matter. If there's one thing we know about matter, it is that it is not always the same. Its composition is changing. It's not always the same as it has always been. And in any case, the steady state theory conflicts with the second law of thermodynamics, which says that the Earth's available energy is actually running down all the time. And so people think backwards and say, well, if it's running down, it must at one stage, if you like, have been wound up. The second possibility is that it's self-created. In the 19th century, many scientists got excited by the idea of spontaneous generation. Things that brought themselves into being. And some went so far as to say the entire universe came into being in that way. The entire universe brought itself into existence. Well, surely it's not difficult to see a fatal flaw in that. You see, bringing something into existence is an activity. And there must be something to engage in the activity. So if the universe did not exist, what is it that existed in order to bring itself into existence? I think you can get some aspirin down in the book table afterwards if that confuses you. But it seems to me to be ridiculous. If it didn't exist before it existed, it couldn't have been there to bring itself into existence. Oh, and then in any case, it conflicts with the first law of thermodynamics, which says that energy and matter can neither be self-created nor can they be completely destroyed. Now, there is only one alternative, and that is that the universe was brought into existence by a transcendent reality, that is, one greater than itself. Now, I'm glad I've been able to bring in the word transcendent, because I love the word transcendent. One of my favorite English words. In fact, it's only got one other competitor. Crème brûlée. Except that that's two words in French, so transcendent wins even there. It must have been brought into being by a transcendent reality. It is said that to have the universe as we know it requires five things: time, intelligence, energy, space, and matter. Now watch this. Those five things are all there in the first verse in Genesis. In the beginning speaks of time. God speaks of intelligence. Created speaks of energy. The heavens speaks of space. And earth speaks of matter. What's there not to like about that? The five things we're told are absolutely essential if we're to have the universe we have, and they're all there in the very first verse in the Bible. Look, everything that had a beginning had a cause. This lectern had a beginning. It had a cause. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, it had a cause. Think about that. And think about this. The God we find in the Bible, eternal, transcendent, all-powerful, intelligent, and self-existent, fits the bill exactly. Do I say that proves the existence of God? No, it doesn't. And I'm very careful not to go that far. I've spent the last 15 years of my life doing almost nothing but what I've called popular Christian apologetics, defending the Christian faith against its attacks. And I try very hard, especially in an audience which is largely non-Christian, to make the point, I'm not going to prove the existence of God, but I'm going to ask, where does the evidence point? And I put it to you that the fact that we need time, intelligence, energy, space, and matter fits in entirely with the Bible story that God created the heavens and the earth, and I say, that points in that direction. And what about the nature of the universe? The universe is not a haphazard pile of junk. It's governed by laws which are universal and dependable and cannot be denied. For example, the law of gravity says that a free-falling object accelerates at the rate of 981 centimeters per second per second. When I was at school, it was 32 feet per second per second. But as you now know, I was at school sometime in the 17th century, or so Tim was trying to convince you earlier. Never in all of my existence has such a rude thing been said before I was introduced. Is anybody here older than Dr. Blanchard? And everybody sat. And everybody sat there like this, you know. The way you sit when the All Blacks get their fifth try. Now listen, kids. Why is that the law of gravity? Did a government decide it? Did a powerful group of movers and shakers decide, all in favor of 981? Look, man didn't decide it, he discovered it. And here's something Stephen Hawking says. It would be completely consistent with everything we know to say that there was a being who was responsible for the laws of physics. Isn't that interesting? The most popular idea these days, of course, is that of the hot Big Bang, or the Big Bang, which says that 15 billion years ago, the entire universe was so tiny, well, almost for laymen, the word now used is singularity, but there was a dot of something that could have passed through the eye of a needle with room to spare. And then it went bang. And 15 billion years after the expansion, here we are. Well, let me tell you something you rarely hear on the secular media. Big Bang is a theory and not a proven fact. It is one that is rejected or questioned by many leading scientists. And this is partly because many of the figures quoted, many of the values, if you will, are no more than estimations. Here is Stephen Hawking again. Stephen Hawking admits that if these were proved to be even 10% out of tune, the Big Bang idea would have to be abandoned. Steve Jones, I think I mentioned him in the earlier session, lectures at London University in genetics, said this: it might be that the Big Bang will turn out to be a small flop. And Steve Jones is an atheist and a passionate one at that. Even if we accepted the general fundamental idea of a Big Bang, surely there is a fundamental problem for the atheist. Where did the singularity come from? A friend of mine discussing it with a Big Banger said to him, "Could you tell me what went bang?" And that was nearly the end of that discussion. Where did the matter come from? Where did the energy come from? And there's something else. Explosions, and that was some explosion, never produces order and discipline. It produces disorder and chaos. And we don't live in chaos, we live in a cosmos, from which we do get the word cosmetic. So, and governed by these inflexible, universal, dependable laws of physics. That's not what you would expect from an explosion. If I dropped a fragile glass onto a concrete floor, 10 meters below, it would smash into a million pieces. If I did it again, same thing would happen. When 9/11 happened, there was an explosion. What was left was not order. It was chaos. There was order, then there was an explosion, then there was chaos. What are the chances of the Big Bang producing elegant, ordered laws of physics? A man called Roger Penrose, who worked with Stephen Hawking on the subject of black holes in the universe, estimated the chances of an explosion producing the order and discipline we see in the universe were, and I quote, 1 in 10 raised to the power of 10 raised to the power of 123. And if you're saying, what in the world does that mean? Join the club. When I was at school, maths, not my strong point. My fractions were vulgar, and my decimals were pointless, and they haven't improved very much since. But Penrose helps us here. He says that number is greater than the total number of fundamental particles in the entire universe. But those are the chances of it happening just like that. Now, what is the Bible's take on the vastness, the brilliance, the beauty, the order, the discipline, the reliability of what we see? The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. So, the existence and the nature of the universe point toward Russell being wrong when he said, well, there's not enough evidence that there's a God. Now, the second is what I'm calling the mystery of life. When I wrote the book, I decided to have a chapter called On Life, and I called it, this wording would not be original, Such is Life. I thought, now it'd be good to have a definition. So I got to my dictionary, looked at the word living, and it said animate. So I'll go back to the animate. It said living. So I thought, well, that's not much help. So I went up to the local library and looked at an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Fascinating article. And the last sentence in the article said, there is no generally accepted definition of life, unquote. So, we know that a concrete post has no life and a tree does. We know that a donkey has life and a diamond doesn't. But apparently, there is no generally agreed definition of what life is. Then, what is it? And just as important, how did it originate? In 1953, the British scientist Francis Crick breezed into his local pub in Cambridge and announced, "We found the secret of life." What he actually meant was that he and his colleague James Watson had discovered the now generally accepted double helical structure of DNA, which governs all biological reproduction. DNA is what triggers into action all the bits and pieces a living organism needs in order to be a living organism and to grow. Without DNA, the amino acids and all the other bits and pieces would be lying around like toys in a kid's playroom, unused and not doing anything of value. But where did DNA come from? It's one thing to say DNA is what kickstarts life. I want to know, what is it that kickstarts DNA? Now, the bottom line is that DNA houses genetic information. Doesn't create it, it houses it. And let me illustrate how much. The information in a single chromosome in a human body contains the equivalent of 500 million words. To illustrate, it would take over 2,000 books of that size to contain the intelligence in one single chromosome. But a single fertilized human egg has 23 pairs of chromosomes, that is 46 chromosomes. So it would need, are you ready for this, 90,000 books of that size to write out the intelligence in one single fertilized human egg. But the information in DNA is not the product of DNA. So where did the intelligence come from? Let me try to illustrate this for you. When I had the idea of writing this book, I came up with the title fairly easily. Titles seem to be my thing. I want to write a book called Does God Believe in Atheists? That'll get people's attention. So I got out some sheets of paper. Those are actually in the original version in my pre-computer days. And I got out some sheets of paper and began to write. And my wife came in and said, what are you doing? I said, I've got a great idea for a book called Does God Believe in Atheists? Are you speaking at a conference this weekend yet? Are you ready for it? No. Don't you think you should be preparing for the conference and not this book with this silly title? I just made that bit up. But anyway, and I said, do you know, I think you're right. Well, I'd done about a page, and I had about five sheets on the desk, so I just left it there, prepared, went off, did the conference, came back, went to the blank page, wait a minute, two, three, four, these are all done. That's five pages done. Well, that's terrific. Well, I had other things to do, but shortly afterwards, I was going away for nearly a week, and I thought, well, this wouldn't work twice, would it? So I put 50 sheets under there, and went off and did this week's conference and came back. And honestly, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, this is terrific. I said to Joyce, it's time we had a vacation. Let's go and take a holiday. So I put two reams of paper underneath there. And off we went for 3 weeks. And came back about this high. And the chapters, layout, index at the back, the whole shooting match. Sent it off to the publishers, Evangelical Press, who also published for Gary Gilly, sent it off to the publishers, and back it came, and there it was. Now, I haven't told many audiences in South Africa that story, but it's such a privilege to be here today, I thought I'd share that with you. And if you believe me, please see me afterwards, I've got a second-hand car I want to get rid of. Well, of course, that's not how it happened. Of course it isn't. I mean, upwards of 250,000 words, 2,300 references, 900 people quoted. It took a very long time. And to paraphrase Churchill, talk about blood, sweat, toil, and tears. It took all of the above. Then how did the intelligence in one single fertilized human egg get there? Atheism says, well, it just happened. And it really does. Here is a Harvard scientist, George Wald, winner of the 1967 Nobel Prize for Physiology. When it comes to the origin of life on Earth, there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. Well, we dealt with that a few minutes ago. Spontaneous generation has been disproved. That leads us to only one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. We cannot accept that. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. And they gave him a Nobel Prize. But you'll be pleased to know it wasn't for that nonsense that they gave him a Nobel Prize. Elsewhere, he says this: the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. So you see, here's a man, this is a worldview conference, with a worldview. His worldview says there is no God. Therefore, although it's impossible that it could have happened like this, that's what we're going to believe because the alternative is God and we don't want to bring him into the picture. What's the Bible's take on this mystery of life? Well, here's the Apostle Paul preaching in Athens, that remarkable sermon of his. And we read this. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and observed your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands, and he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because, here it is, he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else." Now that points to the existence of God. It points to Russell being wrong. Then let me say something about, here's the third point, the marvel of mankind. C.S. Lewis once brilliantly said, "You have never met an ordinary person. You meet a human being, you're not looking at an ordinary object. You're looking at an extraordinary object, something truly marvelous and wonderful." Some years ago, there was an academic in England called Professor C.E.M. Joad, most famous, I guess, popularly for appearing on a program called Brains Trust on BBC Radio. And he once famously said that the average human body consists of, wait for it, enough fat for 7 bars of soap. That has to be amended in some cases. Enough iron to make 1 medium-sized nail, enough sugar to sweeten 7 cups of tea, enough lime to whitewash 1 chicken coop, enough phosphorus to tip 2,200 matches, enough magnesium to provide 1 dose of salts, enough potash to explode 1 toy cannon, and enough sulfur to rid 1 average-sized dog of fleas, unquote. So next time you look in a mirror, that's what you're looking at. Except, of course, that's not the end of the story. Here's the human frame with its 100 joints and 200 bones and 600 muscles all working together in perfect harmony. The tendons which anchor muscles to the bones could withstand what, in one currency at least, would be 8 tons per square inch. The hands are amazingly strong, yet wonderfully delicate. The human hand has over 652,000 nerve endings. The human hand is strong enough to wield a pickaxe and delicate enough to construct microsurgery. The human eye is truly phenomenal. It processes 80% of the information that comes into us from the outside. It can handle 500,000 messages simultaneously. The retina, just the tiny retina in the human eye, has 130 million receptor cells. They're not all the same shape. 124 million of them are rod-shaped and differentiate between black and white, or light and darkness, as we might say. And the remaining 6 million are cone-shaped and can distinguish 8 million variations of color. The human brain, which accounts for just 2% of an average person's body weight, has 100 billion neurons, that is, nerve cells. That's the same number of trees that are growing in 2.7 million square miles of Amazonian rainforest. And each one of those 100 billion neurons has connections to up to 100,000 other parts of the human brain. And skeptics hear figures like that and say, well, this is the computer age. We deal with bytes and megabytes and gigabytes and who knows what bytes. I just made that one up. And no good quoting those massive figures at us. The brain is just some super kind of computer. But it's in a different league altogether. Here is Stephen Hawking, for example, saying that today's state-of-the-art computers are less complex than the brains of earthworms. I mean, think with me for a moment of the capability of the human brain as composed to a computer. Computers can't express love, hatred, pride, joy, frustration, anger. We can. I did within a week of getting a computer. Computers can't enjoy lovely music or a beautiful sunset. Computers can't create brains. Brains can create computers. Computers don't even know they're computers, the dumb things. So to say, well, a brain is a kind of computer, is a bit like saying when an elephant is a kind of primrose. I mean, what is the connection? There simply is none. So the human body is truly amazing, and the whole package comes shrink-wrapped in three layers of flexible waterproofing with an inbuilt air conditioning system that we call the human skin. And the atheist says, it just happened. Leave our original speck of dust around long enough, and that's what you get. Send it to college, and it winds up as a brain surgeon. Well, give me a break. Can that really be the answer to that? Are we seriously to believe that all these amazing features came about by accident? Surely it's infinitely easier, it takes less faith, to agree with one of the psalmists who cries out, "You created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Now, I'll grant it to you, that is a statement of faith. None of us was there to see it happen. None of us saw the knitting in our mother's womb going on. So we take it by faith that God created us. But the person who says, well, it's all an accident, there's an explanation, we may not know all the details, but God isn't in it, and just over the years, that's how it came about. You know, there was something, nothing, then there was something, then there's, to use Darwin's fantasy, a warm little pond with chemicals floating around in it, and then because of the atmospheric conditions, somehow or other, one of them became animate, suddenly life appeared out of non-life, and then over millions of years, it became more complex, then it developed backbones, they became vertebrate, and then millions of years later, they found themselves able to come out onto the land and become amphibians, and then a little bit later they developed wings and legs and became birds, and then they became bigger and became four-legged creatures, and so on and so on, until eventually we appeared. That's a lot of faith. I know few Christians with that amount of faith. That's an amazing amount of faith. And then in case, and we touched on this earlier today, we have a moral dimension. We have a sense of right and wrong, good and bad, fair or unfair, just or unjust. Where did that come into the picture? We have consciences, those mysterious moral monitors that say, you should do that, you shouldn't do that. And in doing so, they're referring to a standard. And one that we didn't create. Not everybody has identical moral standards, but there's an amazing consensus about basic values, even when there's no human law involved. For example, I know of no human law against greed, selfishness, covetousness, envy, and jealousy. But why do we think that it's right to call them wrong? Is that what we would expect if we left a speck of dust around for enough millions of years? They would start differentiating between things that were good and things that were wrong. See, in the absence of transcendent moral values, there is no secure moral basis on which we can decide that anything is right or wrong, good or bad. And what one animal does to another animal is morally irrelevant, whether the animals concerned have four legs, two legs, or none. So we have this moral dimension. And we have a spiritual dimension too. It's been said man is a religious animal. He must and will have some religion. The Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics runs to 12 enormous volumes. And the British scientist Sir John Horton, largely involved in the issue about global warming, says there is general evidence that most human beings from whatever part of the world and from the earliest times have exhibited a fundamental belief in a divine being or beings. Now, why? Why in all the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of species are we the only one that apparently has this religious dimension? Wolves don't worship. Snakes don't hold services. Bats don't have Bibles. And come to think of it, not even the praying mantis prays. But we do. Now, why would that be? Richard Dawkins says he has an explanation. He says, and I quote, "It's a virus of the brain," unquote. Dawkins says that teaching children from the Bible should be prosecuted as child abuse. Now, how extraordinary. So the testimonies of millions of people over thousands of years that God has transformed their lives and is a dynamic reality, has given them a coherent worldview, are talking nonsense. In fact, they've got a disease. Dawkins pursues his militant atheism within yards in Oxford, of where men of outstanding integrity and moral fiber were burned alive rather than deny that God is and had a right to be worshipped in the way that he laid down. I mean, he still lives in that area, does Dawkins, but he used to be, you know, the professor for the public understanding of science at Oxford University. He retired from that. He could now be called the professor for the public misunderstanding of religion, because that's what he's doing. That's what he's spending his time doing. And yet these men, head and shoulders above their contemporaries, said, "You can do what you like with us, but we cannot deny the truth." And so they were led out, people like Ridley and Latimer, bonfire arranged around them, and a human braai was held. And they refused to deny the reality of God in their lives. And all I ask is Dawkins qualified to brush their witness aside? If they had a disease, South Africa needs an epidemic of it today. And so does the United Kingdom, and so does the whole world. It's interesting that from time to time, even the most entrenched atheists let a rather large cat out of the bag. Here's the French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre. "Everything in me calls for God." Here's Bertrand Russell, the man with whom we began. "The center of me is always and eternally a searching for something beyond what the world contains." Isn't that honest? Man who spent 50 years and more of his life telling people there's no God says, "Yeah, but there's something in there that the world can't supply." And the truth of the matter is that for every basic need we have, every fundamental need, there's a reality by which that can be met. For example, we all need food or we die. It's not an option. There's enough food to feed the whole world. We all need water to drink or we die. There is enough potable water available or can be made available to satisfy everybody's needs. To be fully rounded human beings, we need love in our lives. There are billions of other people who in some way, in some fashion, at some time, in some place, can help to supply that particular need. And man has a spiritual instinct, a hunger for something beyond all of that. And there are millions of people, it's been the testimony of millions of people over thousands of years, including some of the most brilliant minds in all of human history, that that need can be met. And it's the testimony of millions of people living today that that need is being met by the God of whom the Bible speaks. Now, I began by saying, look, I want to show you four reasons why Russell was wrong in saying there's not enough evidence for God. The first is the nature, the existence and nature of the universe. The second is the mystery of life. The third is the marvel of human life. And the fourth is greater than all of those put together. And it's one human life. And the greatest denial, rebuttal of what Bertrand Russell said is the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And everything we read about him could be summarized actually in one word. Unique. Nobody else in all the billions who've ever lived was exactly like him. He was unique in his conception, not in his birth. The birth of Jesus was perfectly normal as far as we know. It was not how he left his mother's womb that was unique, it was how he entered it. and he entered it not by the normal process of biological human reproduction, but by direct genetic implantation by God the Holy Spirit. His conception was unique. His wisdom was unique. When he was just 12 years of age, there he was, cutting and thrusting with the leading theologians of the day in Jerusalem. And what we read is, they were amazed at his answers. Now, if we'd read, there was this 12-year-old kid, and they were amazed at his questions. How in the world did he come up with questions like that? They were amazed at his answers. Nothing unusual about a little boy asking very testing questions of a Bible teacher. I was preaching in the north of England just a few years ago. Priest on a Sunday morning was taken to a home I'd never been in before for lunch, and they introduced me to their six-year-old boy. I'd have been happier to meet a six-year-old dog. This little darling. Why this and how that and when that and on and on and on, and I thought, for goodness sake, serve the lunch and let's get this over with. That's not what we read here. They were amazed at his answers. So there are these graybeards, having studied the Old Testament for all of those years and centuries before them. Well, we don't know the answer to that, and what about this, and what about that? And Jesus said, this is the answer. He was unique in his miracles. It's been suggested that he may perform more miracles in one day than were performed in 1,000 years of Old Testament history. He was unique in his character. Although he was fully, genuinely, really, totally, actually human, needed to eat and drink and rest and sleep and all the rest of it, knew what it was to be delighted, knew what it was to be distraught, was battered by all kinds of temptation, but was without sin. He was tempted in every way just we are, as we are, yet was without sin. And you rarely meet anybody who even begins to make that kind of claim about themselves. But I was speaking in a house meeting in Scotland a little while ago, a ladies' house meeting. I was going to call it a large house meeting of ladies, but that could be interpreted as a meeting of large ladies, so I won't go there. But anyway, and at some point I must have mentioned forgiveness or something. And I caught out of the corner of my eye a lady I thought was shaking her head. And I said, excuse me, do you have a problem with what I've just said? Well, yes. Tell me, have you never prayed for forgiveness? No. Why have you never, ever once prayed for forgiveness? Don't you think you've ever done anything for which you need to be forgiven? And she said, no. Now, it was a kind of local community, and I guess they all knew her. So I said, tell me, do you know this lady? And all the heads went like this. Oh, yeah, we know this lady. And I said, do you think she's perfect and has no need for forgiveness? It was like watching Wimbledon in high speed. It was, they were all going like this. And Jesus was without sin. His death was unique. It's the only voluntary death in all of history. And you say, well, now, wait a minute. Person who commits suicide volunteers to die. No, he doesn't. He's going to die anyway. He may choose the day, the date, the time, the place, and the method, but he doesn't choose to die. Jesus did. No man can take my life from me. I lay my own life down, he said. Then why did he die? Why do we all die? Why is death, and think carefully what I'm about to say now, why is death so popular? Death is hugely popular. Everybody's doing it. We'll make no further reference to age either, but everybody's doing it. And the reason is that sin came into the world through one man and death through sin. So death passed to all men because all have sinned. You and I are sinners because of original sin, which was passed down to us. And you and I are dyers because we're sinners. I speak as a dying man to dying men and women. But here's a conundrum. Death is caused by sin. Sin causes death. The soul that sins will die. Sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. The wages of sin is death. Jesus had no sin and died. Wait a minute. So he bore the effect and didn't have the cause. And the Bible's answer to that apparent conundrum is this: Christ died the righteous in the place of the unrighteous to bring them to God. Astonishingly, amazingly, he bore in his own body and spirit the penalty for the sins of a multitude whom no man can number. So his death was unique. His resurrection was unique, the only one in all of history. You said, no, wait a minute. Some in the Old Testament and some in the New too. No. I'd prefer to call them resuscitations for this reason. And let me give you an illustration of it. The widow of Nain's son. Here's this young man being carried to his funeral. We can imagine he died that day. That's the way that's done in that part of the world. Jesus interrupts the cortege and raises him to life. Now let me try to illustrate. So here he is. Or he was, he's died, he's being carried to the cemetery, Jesus speaks, and he gets raised to life. Instantly. What is the very first thing he begins to do as soon as he's been raised to life? He begins to die all over again. He does. And so, and I'm using my imagination a little bit here, so 10 years later, two friends are meeting in a coffee shop in Jerusalem. One says, did you hear what happened to Joseph yesterday? No, what happened to him? He died. Oh, I remember when he first did that 10 years ago. That's not as crazy as it sounds. Because here was a man who lived, died, rose again, and died again. This is what makes Jesus unique. Christ being raised from the dead cannot die again. Death has no more mastery over him. And we're meeting here today not because there was a great hero who lived a perfect life and was dead and buried and that's the end of it. We are meeting here in the living presence of one who did die and was raised from the dead and cannot die again, our living, eternal Savior. His claims were unique. You remember Muhammad Ali saying, I am the greatest. Well, in my snatches of my CV earlier, Tim didn't mention what he didn't know, that when I was a young man, I was a boxer. And I did meet Muhammad Ali. But that's only partial. I met him outside of the ring, you'll be pleased to know, and not inside of it. And his big deal was, I am the greatest. And maybe he was, at that stage, the greatest pound-for-pound fighter the world has ever known. But here's someone who's greater. I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. I'm the bread of life. He who eats of me will never hunger. I'm the water of life. He who drinks of me will never thirst. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Oh, and even greater, when one of his disciples said, could you show us the Father? Which essentially means, look, we're working people, we're fishermen and whatever. Seeing is believing, and you've talked about the glory of God, the power of God, the love of God, the kingdom of God. Just show us God, and that'll clinch it for us. And Jesus said, young man in his early 30s, didn't possess any property, didn't have a paid job, wasn't earning a pension, had to borrow a boat to go across Galilee, had to borrow a donkey to ride into Jerusalem, had to borrow a coin to give an illustration. He said, have I been with you for so long? And you still don't know who I am. If you've seen me, you've seen him. Nobody's been able to make that claim and to sustain it. But he made it and he can sustain it and did. Because if God became a man, if we were musing on that extraordinary possibility, he would have to be perfect. He would have never to make a mistake, never to tell a lie, never to ask for forgiveness. He'd be able to change the weather when he wanted to, be able to heal any person's sickness that he chose to. And if by some happenstance he were to die, he would not stay dead. He would rise again from the dead. And that is Jesus. Did exactly those things. So the existence or the non-existence of God doesn't depend on the tally of experts who may say so. If every PhD in the world was an atheist, it wouldn't make atheism any stronger. And if every PhD in the world were a Christian, it wouldn't make Christianity any stronger than it is. Because Christianity is based solely on the person of Jesus Christ, our God and Savior. And it's the testimony of millions that he can be taken at his word. And so to those of you who are Christians, take heart. You've got a good case. History is on your side. Humanity is on your side. The Bible is on your side. So don't be afraid and don't be ashamed to testify about our God and Savior. And to anybody here who has come because, well, it'd be interesting to know what these guys think, and you might be an atheist or an agnostic or a skeptic, and I would offer this advice to you to go out there, if this is partly an equipping conference, to go out there. First piece of advice I would give to your atheistic, agnostic, skeptical friend is, think again. Not think, that would be patronizing. I was in a McDonald's in the United States having a cup of coffee some years ago, and I saw this guy walking around the restaurant with his coffee cup, and, well, he was a weird-looking specimen. And forgive me saying that, and I only say it for one reason. He was weird-looking. I hope he doesn't see me. Because you know what happens? He comes straight to my table, shoves his face in mine, and says, "I didn't want to interrupt you." And I thought, well, that makes two of us. And he said, "Want to ask you a question?" I said, "Go ahead." He said, "Where did thought come from?" And then he made as if to go away. And then he came back and said, "Now that makes you think, doesn't it?" And off he went. End of conversation. I wish I could hug his neck. At the time, I wished I could wring it, but now I wish I could hug it. What a great thing. Listen, as you go out into a world that is skeptical, becoming increasingly agnostic, being peopled more and more by those who are atheists, if you meet a person who says, "Well, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God," whatever you do, please, please, please don't bash them over the head with a Thompson Chain Reference Bible or any other version. Don't. Whatever you do, don't say, "But the Bible says." That's the worst thing you could do. Person says to you, "Well, I'm an atheist." Listen, hear me carefully. Ask questions. The best piece of advice I can give to anybody who seeks to witness to other people is ask questions. "I'm an atheist." "Really? How long have you been an atheist? When did you become an atheist? How did you become an atheist? Why did you become an atheist? Who did you read? Who did you listen to? What did they say that particularly impressed you? Tell me five things about this God you don't believe in." And on and on and on. And that's the way to do it. It honestly is. And at some point you'll be able to say to them, "And where did thought come from? If there's no God, how in the world should you..." Look, if your brain was not created by an intelligent God, why in the world are you trusting it to give you intelligence when it wasn't created for that purpose? That makes sense. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, just get with the program, guys, kids, and just learn to use the brain power that God has given you and the common sense that God has given you and tackle those who disbelieve in that particular way. So Bertrand Russell says, I'd look him straight in the eye and say there wasn't enough evidence. And I say, in this worldview conference, and as my plenary part of it comes to an end, I would say, well, the existence and nature of the universe would certainly suggest that there's a God. And the mystery of life, and the marvel of human life, and of course, one particular human life. So let me close again by thanking Tim and others for inviting me. You've been very gracious to do that. And I'm doing a tour of South Africa on behalf of or invited by Christian Book Discounters. You'll have seen their table downstairs. I'm just so grateful for the way that company, in God's goodness, has expanded over the years. I was in fairly near the beginning of it, and I was the guinea pig. Let's see if we can get a speaker over and take him around the country and so forth. And they've done that with Gary and others. And it's been great to see the way it's developed and the terrific efforts they make to get stuff in here, to discount it, and then get it spread all around the country. And you've seen some of the stuff that's available, so let me just remind you of one, introduce you to another, and tell you something extraordinary about the last one, and then I'm through. I think about half the many copies of The Hitchhiker's Guide to Heaven that were available this morning have gone. So if you want to make sure of getting a copy of that, you'd better get your skates on because it really is moving very quickly. Now, exactly opposite that, The Hitchhiker's Guide to Heaven is a book called Whatever Happened to Hell? wasn't here this morning, but has got here this afternoon. Now, if people ask questions about heaven, how many questions do people ask about hell? Where is it? What is it like to be there? Do people stay there forever? Is there a second chance? What about purgatory? Do they know of friends and relatives who are in heaven? What about the fire? What about the worm that never dies? What about the, is the punishment really eternal or does it stop? And so on and so forth. J.I. Packer has been kind enough to write the foreword to that book, which has just been reissued by Evangelical Press in what they're calling the John Blanchard Classic Series. Tim told them how old I was, and so they're producing a series of my books and calling them classics. And so that is one. And young man, you will not forget that in a while, I promise you. And then one last thing. Our title this afternoon has been, Does God Believe in Atheists? And it's difficult to tell you the whole story of how we happen now to have brand new hot off the press copies right here today. They were shipped from England, meant to be unloaded at Cape Town. A mistake was made. They went on to Port Elizabeth. Then they came back to Cape Town. Now they had to be got up here. When we got to the conference, they hadn't arrived. And so while I was doing my first session, somebody from CBD was going out with my colleague Howard Williams to Johannesburg Airport. They were there nearly 2 hours being able to lay hold of them, and as the result of which, they are here. And about a third of the copies they were able to get were already bought before we got into this particular session today. Well, I've been in doing apologetics now for 15 years. Every subject I've ever tackled is handled in this particular enormous volume. It now runs to 850 pages. And any of the subjects you care to think of, be it evolution or angels or creation or morality or evil and suffering and where is God when things go wrong and all of those things, why, how should we trust the Bible, what about the person of Christ, and of course the question of coming, of getting right with God. There's a massive index at the back and you can just turn up your own subject, go straight to that part and read it without necessarily reading the whole book. But I think there's only about 20 copies that are left. And so only the first 20 people can get it. And I'm going to, as Tim, I think, comes up here to close this down, I'm going to dash down there so that I will be there, and I'll be happy to sign that copy and copies of any other titles for you. And I trust that there'll be a means of great, great blessing to you in the days to come. But you'll see it just as you go in, a socking great pile of them, this big green book, Does God Believe in Atheists? And when you've read it, it also is wonderful as a doorstop. And so that was a second reason. Thank you very much.